I'm here with Tony Natale, who is the author of The Program, Inside the Mind of Keith Raniere and the Rise and Fall of NXIVM. Tony was a key player in the downfall of NXIVM and the first whistleblower, one of the first whistleblowers. Tony, can you talk about, you know, tell the listeners who you are, first of all, and also how you started to try and bring this to the attention of the public?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the time, and any time that we can educate people or share with them information that may wake them up to a coercive control organization or individual, it's an important thing for people to hear. I met Keith in the early 90s, and at the time he was presenting himself as a businessman. So my original connection with him was that level of a business person. And to make a long story short, in 98, when he met Nancy Salzman and they created what would eventually be NXIVM, it was called Executive Success Program at the time, I took the pilot program. I went through the first 16 days, the first level of classes and modules. And for me, it was a frightening experience because Nancy had been my therapist. And what I saw in that coursework was a lot of manipulation and a lot of maybe even the first collateral that was happening, and wanted desperately to not have anything to do with it. And my young, naive self at the time thought that although I had tried once before, that breaking up with Keith was going to be as simple as breaking it off. And that's not what happened. So for the past 20 years, I've been desperately trying to get the authorities to pay attention to what I perceived as a litigious and dangerous organization. The last words Keith said to me was, last time I saw him prior to his arrest, was April of 1999. And he said, the next time I see you, you'll be dead or in jail. And he tried for 20 years. The time of his arrest, he was still suing me. He was suing me in the state of Washington and trying to have me extradited to Mexico on false charges. And when you have that kind of money and power behind you, it's hard to get people to listen because the political landscape was paved with a lot of Rothman dollars. So who are you going to listen to? Someone that's a wealthy heiress has that kind of a connection or that kind of name, or an ex-girlfriend that's they deemed crazy?
So who did you go to? Did you have anyone on your side?
Well, the Forbes article came out in 2003, and it was pretty sensational. I mean, I think it laid out a lot of the truth about what years later people found out. The media was my ally, the real journalists that cared to look into the story. Michael Friedman from Forbes magazine, Dennis Husko from the Albany Times Union, Chet Hardin from Metroland, Jim Audato from the Times Union, Susanna Andrews from Vanity Fair, Jeannie Mack from New York Post. So it was the reporters that I worked with over the years that would pump the stories out, hoping that the authorities would say, we really need to take a look at this. And yet it wasn't until we got to the point where Sarah Edmondson bravely put her body on the front page of the New York Times, you know, branding a woman was not okay, that it made that shift. And Catherine Oxenberg from, you know, she had fame in Dynasty in Hollywood, lent her name to the cause. You know, it took a collective group of people to really band together to push hard enough and make enough noise for the authorities to come around.
What was the authorities' reaction in the beginning?
In the early days or at this and last
before round? The tipping point of the branding?
They believed them over us. Information that was given to the Northern District of New York about Keith trolling on Facebook pages of young girls, or a woman that had written, actually she wrote the letter to Chet to his old Metroland account in September of 2013, 2013. And we put it in the book, and we put it in the book because we're hoping that she's willing to come forward now, that she doesn't have to be afraid to be alone anymore. And what she did was she literally laid out Doss and Janice and what was happening and her fears in Mexico about what was going on. That letter was sent to the authorities, but they claim that they never received it. And instead they raided my home and the home of two other people that were trying to get the information out. Information was sent to the Attorney Generals of New York. And we actually got an email back saying, stop sending information, we'll get back to you. So whether it be, we see the Weinsteins and the Epsteins and Keith Raniere, the very powerful people that are, their sexual preferences are so disturbing that we've either allowed them to become normalized or allowed them to hide in plain sight. Weinstein helped us in a way to show the world that this is really happening. So it made it more acceptable in a way to try to expose the underbelly of NXIVM. And then with Epstein, that was, and sadly, I think there's more.
Can you talk about the role of social media in all of this, both in the way that NXIVM used social media as a recruitment tool and the way that victims have used social media, especially in the hashtag MeToo movement, to raise awareness of, as you say, these perverted sexual preferences?
I think everything has two sides. Like the knife in the hands of a surgeon is a scalpel, and the knife in the hands of a murderer is a murder weapon. So if you take social media and you go out there with your name, your real name, and you speak your truth, and you follow a responsible course of action in information that you're putting out, so that you're not hurting other people maybe in the same situation, or you're not ousting or outing someone else, but you put the information out there in a way that is consistent and it's correct, because as we talked about earlier, journalism is not what it was. So where else do people go to get, you know, their pieces of information? I think that the people that victim shame and, you know, go out there and not using their own names or reinventing things as they want them to be seen because of their own participation or helping someone of a more substantial political position hide what they're doing or what they've been doing. It's a tough call.
How did NXIVM use social media to recruit? Did Keith use pseudonyms?
I've said this before. Keith's very lazy. So did Keith, you know, use anything? Probably not. He'd have other people go do it for him. It's hard to say. None of that came out in the trial. But they did use social media, and they used the power of the people that they drew in, the influences of people like Allison Mack and anyone with a name associated with them to draw people into their communities.
And what's happened with Allison Mack now and those other, the Seagram's heiress and the other random wealthy influencers in this story?
Well, sadly, some of them have gotten away so far. You know, Claire Brofman is scheduled to be sentenced on January 8th. Keith is going to be sentenced on January 17th. And the courts can change these dates, but at this time, Kathy Russell, who was the bookkeeper, I don't really know. She's somewhere in January. So we're waiting for Nancy Salzman, Lauren Salzman, her daughter, and Allison Mack to be sentenced. The judge hasn't named their sentencing dates as of yet.
So the common thread between these high-profile cases, the Weinstein case, the Epstein case, Keith Raniere, seems to be wealth and money and
Right.
Why do you think that is?
In order for them to get away with what they've gotten away with for so long, there has to be a paper trail. So there has to be money to cover that up. It's not normal to have sex with a 15-year-old girl or want to have sex with young women or have... The people that were involved in the inner circle, the people that were part of Keith's core that helped him, enabled him, that were adults, that knew what they were doing was being involved in a relationship with multiple people or with a man that was the involved with other women. They're adults. They get to make that choice. That's their choice. But when you start bringing children into it and grooming children, because that's more of a sexual preference, and then supporting that, it's a problem. It's a problem.
Can you tell our listeners about what's in your book?
Sure. What's in our book? Our book, you know, it's
co-written also by Chet Hardin.
Chet Hardin, yes. Former Metroland reporter extraordinaire. Yes, I'm very lucky to have Chet as my partner. We go through, it's a memoir in effect of, you know, what I saw on my side of the world and what Keith had done to myself and to my family. I lost both of my parents, with them both thinking that I was going to be going to jail for charges that were false. And I lost a brother who died in 2009 to an apparent suicide, although I don't believe that he got up that morning and said, well, I think today's the day. But 9 years of being just relentlessly pursued by this organization, litigating us into oblivion, I think that he was in a really bad place and over-medicated. But one of the things that they teach, a module in effect, is, you know, when is suicide honorable? So if you're not a value to your family, aren't you doing them a service by not being there? And I know that Keith was in touch with my brother. I heard this from one of the women who had later left. And I know my brother was desperately trying to get him to just leave us alone. So I talk about, you know, the years of, as we were being litigated into oblivion, watching him be raised up as a deity and wondering what is it that these people don't see? That it was so clear to me. And why was it allowed to go on for so long? And, you know, the things that we did, I did, others did to stop it.
So details in this case are still unraveling. People are still missing that are relevant. There are so many players in this story.
Yes.
How can people, if they have information, who do they get in touch with? And how can we get in touch with you and maybe find your book?
We have a website called The Fall of Nexium, NXIVM.com, and we have .com, and we have a Facebook page of the same name, Twitter handle. And if you know, there are people out there that know about a lot of things. The Eastern District of New York is an amazing... They're amazing law enforcement that understand this story and know this story. And especially coming from someone like me that has been so abused by the legal system, can be very much trusted. If someone has information, we have a spot on our website that they can contact Chet or myself, and we will keep anything they want private, personal, help people guide them to resources that they may need for them, for themselves or for their families.
Just one more question. You say you've been litigated into oblivion. Are you still being litigated into oblivion, or has there been any assistance for the victims in these cases?
Yeah. At the time of Keith's arrest, he was suing me in the state of Washington and trying to have me extradited to Mexico on false charges. As I know right now, knock on wood, there are no pending charges. And hopefully there won't be. Hopefully they're done using the legal system as a stalking device to silence people. Obviously, I'm not going to be quiet. I think they know that by now. So hopefully they'll give up and go away. But and I think that the victims will have their time. I know that the sentencing's coming up, and I've been asked to put in a victim impact statement, and we'll see if I'll get my opportunity to be able to tell him what I have to say, and a couple of other people that I have a few words I'd like to share with them.
Well, Tony, I certainly applaud you for your bravery in telling your story, and thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me.